It's certainly good to see each of you tonight. We're thankful to have Brittany's mother and grandmother with us this evening. It's always good to have Brian and Emily with us. And I think the rest of us are home folks. But it's good to have you too. We've had a good day today. Our attendance this morning was up. We had several visitors. We've got a good crowd tonight. And it's just good to be together and worship God together. Our lesson tonight is lesson number 9 in a 10 lesson series that we're having from Luke 15. We have given this chapter a going over. We've had several lessons from the prodigal son. We talked about him as he left home. We talked about him as he came home. A lesson on the father, one on the world, one on the elder brother. And the next lesson, which will be number 10 in the series, and the last, will be what the prodigal son did not say. I think you'll find that to be a rather interesting lesson. But tonight, we're talking about the way down and the way up. The low point of the story of what we call the prodigal son is the hog pen. That's about as low as a Jewish boy could go. Considered to be shameful. And I'm sure it was painful to him in many ways when he was in the hog pen. But he didn't get there overnight. And he didn't put his life back together overnight. There are some steps down and there are some steps up. Now before we look at the steps, 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 7 of them, from where he was to where he was in the hog pen, and 5 basic steps that he took to come back, I want you to think about 4 areas of his life. In the first place, in verses 11 and 12, he was morally unhappy. Evidently, he was living a decent life as one of the sons at home. And I think we could describe his life, at least as far as what we know, as being a decent life, and we could say maybe a moral life. But he was extremely unhappy. Like many young people at that time and even today, they become dissatisfied with what they have. The grass seems to be greener on the other side of the fence. They think that other people have more than they have, and they want to experience some of the things in life. But before he left, he was morally unhappy. After he left, we might describe his life in verse 13 as immorally happy. He seems to have been doing what he wanted to do. And I would guess when he first left home, with all the money that he had and the possessions that he had, that he was one happy lad. I have a friend in Henderson who inherited some money. His mother passed away back about a year or so ago. And he inherited some money, and I'm afraid that he's wasted most of it. He told me the other day that he didn't have much left. He has been living it up in a sense, and he's not been involved in immoral things, but he's been spending money at a fast rate, and he's now to the point that he doesn't have a lot. He has not been immoral, but he's been happy in what he's doing. And I believe in the case of this son here in Luke 15 that we could describe that part of his life as immorally happy. Then in verses 14 through 20, I would describe his life as immorally unhappy. He was still living away from home. He was in the far country. He may have still been involved in what's described as riotous living, but he had come to realize that that wasn't the kind of life that he needed. And so in this mire of sin, about as low as he could go, where he had been happy in that kind of life, he came to realize that it didn't pay, that this was not the kind of life that would give you back what you needed. And so he became unhappy, very unhappy, as you analyze the things that he said. Then he turned his life around and went back home. And as far as we're able to determine, continued from that point to live a decent life and was at that point morally happy. He was back living the kind of life that he had lived as a young man. Basically, I'm sure he didn't have all the things he had then. He'd spent a lot of it, and the inheritance belonged to his brother now. But he was back in a situation where he could be happy, and every indication is he was happy to be back at home. So think about those four areas of his life. First, he was morally unhappy. Then he was immorally happy. Then he was immorally unhappy. And then he was morally happy. And it might be good for all of us just to pause at this point and ask the question, which one of those four would come nearer describing my life and yours today? I don't think we are in either of those cases of immorally happy or immorally unhappy. We make our mistakes, but I don't believe those of us that are here tonight are living lives that are immoral. So we're either morally unhappy or morally happy. We're all living decent lives, and the question is, are we happy with it, or are we really unhappy with the way we're living? Now, having set those four stages, let me suggest to you that there are seven steps down from where he was at the top at home to where he reached the bottom in the hog pen. And all seven of these words will begin with the letter D. First, there was the desire. He was not happy with what he had. He wanted something else. Our wants get us into trouble. It has been said that if you had a list of the wants and wishes of our great-grandparents, maybe grandparents, and you had a list of what's considered necessary and needs today, that our need list today would be longer than their wish list of a few years ago. It's easy for us to have the wrong kind of desires and not be satisfied with what we have. I think all of us go through a stage of where that's a part of our lives. And sometimes we don't enjoy what we have because we're always looking for things that we think we need and think we want and don't have. But that was his first mistake. It had to do with his desires. He had what he needed, at least as we look at it. He had the best of everything, seemingly at home, and yet as he looked out yonder into the other country, looked at how other people were living, he began to have the wrong desire, and he went to his father and said, "Father, here's what I want. Give me my inheritance." Secondly, he made the wrong decision. Out of his desire, he could have made the right decision. I suppose that all of us have entertained ideas of what might be on the other side of the fence or what might be out there in the world, and yet we analyze it and decide that we need to stay where we are. We don't go after it. He might have had those wrong desires. In fact, a desire is not necessarily a sin. Lust is the sin. Having the desire is not a sin until it becomes lustful, and especially even with lust, when we act upon that attitude and that desire. But he made the wrong decision. He put his desires into action. And so he made the decision to ask for his inheritance, that it be divided and that it be given to him. In the third place is the idea of departure. He had the desire, then he made the decision of what he was going to do, and then he carried through with that decision and he departed. He left home. I wonder how many people there are today who made the decision to leave home who wish maybe sooner than he did that they were back at home. And it's not uncommon for those my age to even say today, "I thought I had the meanest mother or the meanest father when I was growing up, and now I realize that they loved me in doing what they did." But he decided to leave home. He ran away in a sense, in another sense he didn't, because his father knew he was leaving. He didn't run away just to get away, but he departed. And he left that which he had. In the fourth place, as he was going down, he put distance between him and his family. Maybe more so than just in mileage. But it says that he went into a far country. I don't know whether the word "far" there is intended to suggest a long distance in miles as much as it is a distance in the different type of lifestyle. But at least he put some distance between him and his father. He didn't want somebody telling him what to do. How many times have you heard a young person say, "Well, I don't like to be preached at. I don't like people telling me everything. I want to make my own decisions, and so I'm going to put some distance between, and I'm going to get away." Sometimes it's good to get away for a while. Sometimes it's good to have a little bit of distance. I used to say that I thought every new married couple ought to live far enough away from their parents that the phone was long distance. But now that we have cell phones, it doesn't make any difference, so I've got to quit that idea. But he put distance in the wrong sense. He put distance between him and his family. And then in the fifth place, as he went down, there's the idea of deception. Perhaps this is more involved than we even think at first. He went out into this far country, and he wasted his living in riotous living, or wasted his money in riotous living. I don't know exactly what kind of action he took. I know what his elder brother accused him of later, and I have no reason to disagree with the elder brother. He may very well have spent his inheritance with the wrong kind of people, and at least it's described in the Bible as riotous living. And that involves deception. The devil is good at deception. Evil men and seducers wax worse and worse, deceiving and being deceived, Paul said to the young man Timothy. And that's very much involved. You hear a lot said about these scams today that try to take away the money of older people, but it's not just there. It's happening all the time. It may not be to that extent, but look at the invitations that are out there in the world. Is that, come on, look what this will do. And I don't know whether you've ever noticed or not, but just about every advertisement or commercial that's on television that's advertising something that we don't need will have the prettiest people and the prettiest scenery of any of the commercials on television. I think that the Budweiser commercials, for example, down through the years, have been some of the best produced commercials that I've ever seen. And they make it appear that if you're with the in crowd and you're going to amount to something, this is what you need. I would suspect that this son had that kind of presentation made to him as he went out into the world, a young man that had money to spend, had people to take advantage of him, and he had the problem of deception. Then in the sixth place, there is the problem of degradation. He was just about as far as he could go. He began to realize probably earlier than this chapter tells us specifically, that he'd made some mistakes, and he began to see what was going on, probably ask himself the question, why did I do this? What in the world am I doing here? What's the value in all of this that seemed to be so great and so important? Now he begins to look at it, and his life could be described as degradation. And then the bottom part is desperation. Here is a young man who, short time before, thought he had everything. Thought he had it all. Thought he could control every situation. Thought he could pay for anything that he needed to pay, and that he could have any kind of friend that he wanted, and any kind of possession that he wanted. And now he's in the hog pen so hungry that he would even eat the husk off the grain that he was feeding the pigs. Now, think about how desperate that is. The job that he had was considered as low as you could go, and yet he was so hungry in that job that he was willing to eat the husk off of that which he was feeding to the pigs. Desperation. And I would point out in passing this, lest we miss it somewhere else in the lesson, sometimes a person has to hit rock bottom before he can start up. And as I pray for those that I love and friends that I have that have gone in the wrong direction, one of my constant prayers is that God will give them time to realize what's happening and to make whatever changes need to be made so that the end result can be what it ought to be. I'm not as concerned about what's happening today to some of my loved ones and friends as I am what's going to be the end result down there. What's going to be the final result? What's going to happen in the future? But here's a young man who was in desperation. And when a person is desperate, he really begins to think about the whole scene and will do most anything to change his situation. The seven things we've said is the wrong desire, the wrong decision, departure, distance, deception, degradation, and desperation. But you know, just as surely as there's a way down, there's a way up. I think one of the biggest mistakes we've made in the church, in dealing especially with our young people, is that we've done more telling them how things are wrong than we have to correct the things that are wrong. We are much better as individuals in life, and much better as individuals in the church and the church as a whole, in placing blame than we are in solving problems. And if you'll just stop and think about it, at any point that you are in life, what good is it going to do at that point to place blame? Now, there may be one sense in which you have to think about blame in order to understand what needs to be done to correct it. And we are told to rebuke and reprove, I know that. But I think we've done a much better, more complete job telling people what's wrong instead of telling them what's right. And I made up my mind a long time ago in preaching that any time that I preach about something that's wrong and talk to the audience about things they should not do or something that's sinful if they're there, that I would never close that sermon without talking about what can be done to correct it. Because every time there is a way down, there is a way up. And I want to suggest to you five things that are involved in the way up in this case. And they all begin with the letter A. First, one must accept where he is. You can never correct something that you don't believe is wrong. There's no reason to get out of anything unless it's wrong to be there. So the first thing this young man had to do was to accept the situation. You remember it says he came to himself? In other words, he analyzed self. And he began to think not of what his father had done back when he was at home, although he did remember what his father had and what he was. And he was not analyzing how many people had mistreated him and all the factors that had gone into being where he was. The Bible says he came to himself. There is the idea of accepting one's situation. The second step is to arise. Get some action going. He came to himself and he said, I will go. I'm going to do something about this. And it has been my experience that it is extremely difficult to help somebody come out of a problem unless they want to come out of that problem themselves. Until a person decides that he's going to do something about it. It's almost impossible to get a person to become a Christian until he decides he wants to be a Christian. It's almost impossible to get someone to come back and be restored until he decides, I need to be and I want to be. So there is accepting, and then there is arising. And then number three, there is admitting the problem. Which may start with the acceptance, but goes further. Notice he said, I will go and I will say to my father, I've sinned, I've made mistakes. There are not many times in the Bible where you'll find somebody quoted as saying, I have sinned. In fact, I don't think you can find one place in the Bible where a person said, I have sinned, except under dire circumstances. You remember David didn't say, I have sinned, until Nathan hit him between the eyes with that little story and said, you're the man I'm talking about. From that point on, David's one of the most penitent people that ever lived. But up until that point, it seems like he just couldn't admit it to himself and admit it to others. The prodigal son, I'm sure, at one point, even when he was in the hog pen, would have had difficulty admitting to himself that he was the one that was to blame. So there has to be the admitting. And then there has to be amending. And this is where a lot of people fall short in straightening things out with the Father in heaven. We do wrong, And then we just sort of wander back in and say nothing about it. And maybe don't change too much what's been happening. But this young man was ready to amend it. He said to his father, "I'm not worthy to even be called one of your servants." Now this is the same young man that had said to his father earlier, "Give me what I deserve." But now he says, "I'm not worthy to be called one of your servants. I'm ready to make amends." He understood, the father understood, and evidently the elder brother didn't, that this young man didn't have any more of the inheritance now. He'd already spent his. But even when there was no basic money for him to have, he was ready to come back home and make amends and change his life and live the way he needed to live. And then he was ready to abide. And by that word abide, I mean he was ready to live a lifestyle that was what it ought to be, not just today. I don't think this young man came home to say, "I want things right today," and then forget the rest of his life, although this chapter doesn't treat it. I'm of the opinion that when he came back home, he stayed at home and worked for his father, had the right relationship with his father, at least I have no reason to believe otherwise, and that he began to abide in the right kind of life. Now think about those five words. Number one, accept. Number two, arise. Number three, admit. Number four, amend. And number five, abide. I don't think any of us here tonight are exactly like the prodigal son. We haven't gone so far as to be in the hog pen, I'm sure. But we all do make mistakes, and we get away from the Father sometimes. The distance may not be as far as in this case. And thankfully, we do not have as far to return, and maybe not as much involved in returning. But basically, the same five ideas are involved with all of us all the time. I need to accept myself. You need to accept yourself. And when each of us accepts himself, he'll find that there are some faults. None of us is perfect. We need to put things into action. If I see I've done something for which I need to apologize, I ought to apologize. If I need to repent publicly, I ought to do that. Repent privately between me and God, I ought to do that. I need to accept, I need to arise, and I need to admit. And it's not easy. It's not easy to admit our own mistakes. I said a moment ago, it's not easy to say I've sinned. And I need to make amends. If I've offended somebody, I need to go to him. If I've mistreated someone with word or deed, I need to make amends. Now, sometimes we cannot make amends. A murderer cannot bring back to life the one that he's murdered. And sometimes we may not be able to make amends, but if it's something within our control, we need to make amends. And if it's not in our control, at least let people know that we'll go as far as we can. And then we need to abide, live day by day in the Lord's service. There was a way down to the rock bottom, but there was a way up to come back home to his father. There's a way down for you and me. God doesn't want us to make mistakes, but he'll let us. God doesn't want us to get in conditions that are bad, but he'll let us if we are determined to go in that direction. But thanks be to him, he's there waiting, like the father in this case, ready to run out to meet us, ready to forgive, ready to accept us back, if we're willing to accept ourselves, arise, admit the problem, make amends, and then live for God. I think there's a lesson in this for us. Probably never thought of yourself as the prodigal son, and in a sense, none of us is really to that extent, but the principle is there for all of us. There is a way down. We can all leave God. But there's a way up. We can all come back. And if you are to any degree away from the right relationship with your Father tonight, you need to arise and come to him and be obedient as together we stand and sing.